It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a look at efforts to boost the arts in rural and small-town Wisconsin.
First, Ben Carson just dethroned Donald Trump from the top of national polls as Republican candidates head into their third debate this evening. It's time now for a weekly look at the latest in national politics with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.
Washington, D.C. is a whirlwind of news this week. Congress and the White House have reached a budget deal. Paul Ryan poised to become House Speaker. GOP House members are moving to impeach the head of the IRS, and former House Speaker Dennis Hastert pleaded guilty to a federal financial crime this morning.
Harry Enten joins us every week at this time to talk politics. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So let's look at the Republican primary race. Ben Carson now for the first time up on Donald Trump. So Donald Trump is number two, Ben Carson number one. So what is your take on this? Is this a harbinger of doom for Trump, or is this just a blip that we shouldn't worry too much about? At least you shouldn't worry too much if you're Donald Trump.
I think that most analysts, such as myself, have thought for a while now that the Trump campaign just couldn't sustain itself. I mean, this is Donald Trump we're talking about here. This is somebody who has never really run for political office outside of an aborted run for president in 2000. He makes lots of statements that I think most people would find to be politically incorrect, things that most pundits would normally dismiss that canon, say, oh, he's gone, he's done, forget him. And yet he's remained on top of the national polls. So I think most of us have been waiting for a moment where Trump finally started to lose some steam. And it does seem that that moment, even if it's not upon us exactly, it's the beginning of it. Because we see not only in that one national CBS New York Times poll, we'll want to see more national polls on that, but in the state of Iowa, which obviously hosts the first contest of the primary season, the Iowa caucus, we see that Ben Carson is clearly out ahead there by about 10 percentage points.
So would you read this as voters really liking Ben Carson and his message, or do you read this as Trump fatigue?
It could be read as either, but I think when we can look behind the numbers and we can look at what are called the net favorability numbers, which is voters are asked, do you have a favorable or unfavorable view of a particular candidate? And then if you subtract the favorable minus the unfavorable, you get the net favorability view. And Carson's net favorabilities are something on the order of like plus 70, plus 75, plus 80 in these different Iowa polls, while Trump's are about plus 20. So that's a tremendous difference. But Trump has always been in that neighborhood about plus 20, plus 25, which really isn't actually all that good, considering that if you're a Republican candidate, you expect to be doing very well among Republican voters. So to me, it's finally somebody who actually fits with the idea that voters choose among the most popular candidates to be their number one choice. The numbers are now finally starting to fit. So I think it's both the fact that Carson is so popular and that's why he's ahead, but also the fact that Trump really isn't all that popular, so it's not really surprising that he's behind now. It's more surprising that he was able to stay on top as long as he did.
Well, could you also read this, aside from the favorabilities you were just talking about, is Carson is sort of the anti-Trump. You know, he's quiet, he sounds reasonable, Trump is big and blustery. They're very different personality-wise.
I don't think you could find anyone more different. I guess if you put me in a Montana bar, and I've never been to Montana before, I would fit in as well as Carson would fit in a Trump rally. But if you look at the numbers where each of them are doing well, Carson is doing very well among voters who identify as born-again or evangelical Christian, and they tend to be much more soft-spoken, people who want to hear a message of hope. And Trump is the exact opposite of that. He is blustery. I want to make America great again. America's failing. And Carson just fits much better with who has done well in sort of Iowa in the past. Voters who speak about religion are comfortable talking about religion. And Donald Trump, for all of his, faults and all of his great things, one of his faults is that I just don't think he comes across as all that authentic when it comes to talking about religion.
So you've got that backdrop, and then tonight is the third Republican debate, and if the pass is any indicator, the cameras have loved Donald Trump. The moderators have wanted to hear what he had to say, arguably because the American public wants to hear him talk a lot. So going in, now that he's, maybe looking a little shakier, what is his job tonight?
I think his job is to, for one, try to not have moments like he had in the last debate where Trump is at his best, where he seems to be in control and he's going after people and he doesn't really shy away. And if you look back at that past debate, you saw when the comments that were placed in front of him that he had previously made about Carly Fiorina, and he kind of sort of backed away from them. I think Trump is at his best when he is on the attack, and Trump tonight is going to want to take the offensive. And we've sort of seen that. You know, he's sort of spoken about Carson and spoken about religion and trying to take, you know, come to the forefront with that. Trump just wants to project. It's all about projection with Trump. Trump wants to project winning, and when he doesn't project winning, that's when he's losing.
Now, his candidacy has been criticized from time to time for being short on specifics. So tonight, the center of the debate is supposed to revolve around policy, economic policy. So does that mean he should try to serve up some real statistics, some real plans about the economy?
I don't know that voters at this point particularly care about that, because if voters cared about particular policy, then Donald Trump wouldn't be where he is right now. But voters, you know, this is an economic debate. Obviously, that's where Trump has made his living, is in the economy. So that speaks more to his strength than, say, a debate that revolved around foreign policy. So he will be able to cite numbers, and maybe he can quell some of the people who have been dismissive of his campaign. But look, the truth is that Trump is never going to win over a large portion of Republican voters. And I think where Trump does best is when Trump is talking about his strengths and talking not necessarily in specifics, but I have a plan, I'm going to solve it, even if that plan isn't very specific.
We're talking national politics right now with our political correspondent, Harry Enten from 538. Right now we're taking stock of the Republican debate, which is airing tonight. And so we talked about Donald Trump, and then you've got Ben Carson, who seems to be edging up there. So what does he need to do tonight to maybe solidify the lead that he's building?
So, you know, Carson has been very interesting in these debates. I think, you know, coming out of the first debate in August, most pundits really didn't view Carson as all that strong, but there was a lot of social media buzz about him. Some people who, you know, have been on the ground a lot, talking with a lot of Republican voters, said that he came across as very genuine, a very nice guy, not politics as usual. That's sort of the place where Trump and Carson are very similar. They're not politics as usual. They just go about it in separate ways. And the way that Carson goes about it is being this guy who doesn't get into the mud. And I think that's where Carson does best. But the question's going to be, if Trump goes after Carson, will Carson be able to respond in a way that people see as a strong response? And I don't know what necessarily is a strong response that fits in with how Carson has been running his campaign, this sort of nice guy type of style. If he's able to be dismissive of Trump and make Trump seem small, I think that's really where he wants to be. But the other thing in terms of Carson, again, it's about the specifics, as you mentioned. He hasn't really been all that specific in these debates. He's been just very calm, but that has worked for him so far. So if you keep going well and you're rising, why should you differentiate yourself from the path you've been on?
Who do you think has done a good job at rallying, sparring with Donald Trump? Has anyone stood out to you?
To me, the person who stood out most is probably Marco Rubio. He went after Trump in the last debate. There was, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the last debate, Trump went after Marco Rubio, and Rubio was able to respond. And the way that it seems to work best is that you are able to get into the mud with Trump and sort of, you know, make these semi-funny personal attacks, but then bring it back to policy. Because, as you mentioned earlier, where Trump is weakest is on policy. And eventually votes are going to be determined about policy and where people stand. So if you're going to be successful in getting after Trump, you want to be able to make him seem small by getting in the mud, you know, doing those small little personal attacks, but then bringing it back to policy. And Rubio's been the best at that so far.
Let's take a caller. We've got Charlie on the line here with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is more that in the last week and a half, two episodes have shown that it doesn't appear that people care about our politicians being honest. In particular, Hillary Clinton has been shown to have at least advanced a false narrative that she knew was false with regards to what happened in Benghazi. And you also have Lois Lerner being let off the hook by the Justice Department as she took the Fifth for what happened at the IRS.
And we're going to get to that IRS stuff later on as we talk to Harry. But Harry, looking at some of these Democratic issues that have been talked about in the press recently, are they going to come up tonight? Is it important for Republicans to comment on what they saw, for instance, at the Benghazi hearing?
I think, you know, this is any time that Republicans have a chance to go after Hillary Clinton is a win for them. Hillary Clinton is almost certainly going to be the Democratic nominee now that Joe Biden has decided not to run. And Hillary Clinton's been a name in the press for about 25 years now. And we know that Republicans love to hear red meat going after Clinton. And while Democrats don't like to hear that, that's why Clinton's doing so well, why most Democratic voters don't care about the Benghazi hearings or think that they're partisan proceedings, while Republicans don't believe that at all. So, yeah, I would expect Republicans to try and circle back and go after Clinton, because going after fellow Republicans could be a win, could be a loss, but going after Clinton is always a win for Republicans.
We're talking to Harry Enten right now, senior political writer and analyst for 538, talking about the latest in national politics. The third Republican primary debate is this evening, and the House is preparing for new leadership. We'll be talking about that, too.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the news that Ben Carson is beating Donald Trump in some of the latest national and Iowa polls? Or you can weigh in on the latest news out of Congress. Do you support Paul Ryan as Speaker of the House? What do you think of this new budget deal? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538, looking at the latest in national politics. The third Republican primary debate is this evening, and the House is preparing for new Wisconsin-grown leadership.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the news that Ben Carson is beating Donald Trump in recent national polls? And what do you think about Paul Ryan as a possible, looking more likely, speaker? And what is your take on the budget deal? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're with Harry Enten right now. And Harry, looking now at Paul Ryan, we've been watching, wondering, will he, won't he? It looks now like he will. And he's been nominated by the House. Full host House will vote tomorrow. And last week, you said you didn't think Ryan would become speaker because he had all these caveats attached to his possible speakership. What are you thinking today?
Well, obviously, I was wrong. No, I mean, look, this was an example where Ryan put forward, you know, different sort of things that he said would need to happen. In fact, one of them that he said that would need to happen that didn't actually happen was that he needed the endorsement of the Freedom Caucus, which he didn't get. He got more than a supermajority of support, more than two-thirds support, but he did not actually get the endorsement. And he said, you know what, I've got enough support anyway, so I'm going to run. So I guess Ryan was sort of, in the sense, not lying, but, you know, wanted to get as much support as possible. And then he got enough support and then said, that's good enough for me, and he kept on going. So, you know, Ryan didn't exactly get the criteria that he wanted, but he's going to run, and clearly he's going to be the next speaker unless something dramatic very much changes.
We're going to take a call now. We've got Nick joining us in Appleton. Hi, Nick.
Hey, hi Veronica. Hi, Rob. I guess Paul Ryan, he's from my hometown, Janesville. Honestly, I don't care for him too much. I'm kind of glad he's not going to be the chair of the Ways and Means Committee anymore. I honestly think he'll do less damage there as the House Speaker. And I just can't get over Ben Carson. I mean, I know Donald Trump's just completely out there, but Ben Carson just is like in another universe to me. I just can't believe people actually... I can't get over it. I mean, I think I heard something on NPR how he said he was going to regulate free speech or regulate bias in college campuses. And it was like, somebody said it was like the biggest offense of free speech. Like, I just can't believe people would think that.
All right. Well, Nick, thank you for calling. And you're from Paul Ryan's hometown. He says he's not crazy about Ryan, but he says maybe good that he won't be on the House Ways and Means Committee, according to Nick. What do you think about some of those opinions he's expressing? Are you hearing that?
Yeah, I heard it perfectly fine. I think, let me hit on a few of them. One, you know, being Speaker is a thankless job. I mean, yes, Ryan is going to be able to move certain pieces of legislation, but I think there's a reason why so many Republicans decided that they, in fact, did not want to be Speaker. And so the caller who just called in should be, I guess, I'm not pleased that Ryan is going to have a very tough job ahead of him, but he is going to be shackled by the same things that John Boehner was shackled by, and that is still a very conservative House Republican caucus that's going to be very difficult to move on certain issues. So Ryan is going to be constrained. As for Ben Carson moving up, I think that the caller expresses the opinion of a lot of people who aren't necessarily members of the Republican Party, or at least the members of the Republican Party who are supporting Ben Carson. They can't believe that he's doing so well. And I think that's part of the reason, some of the things that your caller mentioned in terms of free speech and the comments that he's made, that Ben Carson probably is not going to be the Republican nominee. Let's be honest here. I don't think Donald Trump is likely to be so either. These polls are still very early. We don't vote until next year. And so we'll have some fun as Carson and Trump go at it. But chances are it's not going to be either Trump or Carson who are going to be the nominees.
Now, looking at Paul Ryan for a moment, there are some political watchers who think that Ryan could have an easier time than John Boehner because he's more conservative than Boehner, so maybe it's not going to be as tough a job for him. Well, what do you make of that?
Sure. We can look at roll call votes. I did so last week, and that was one of the reasons why I held back, perhaps, and said, you know, I wasn't that sure that Ryan wouldn't be Speaker. I didn't think he was going to end up running for it, but he did. But one of the reasons that I thought he might is because he's significantly more conservative than John Boehner, at least according to his roll call vote record. And not only is he more conservative, but we can sort of judge someone's record by whether or not they tend to go with the establishment as often as they go with the anti-establishment vote. And Ryan is significantly more, at least in his voting patterns, anti-establishment than Boehner, obviously, who was the Speaker of the House, was. And he was about as anti-establishment as the House Freedom Caucus. So he could have an easier time going at it. And also, if we could look at, you know, today or what's coming up later today, is they're going to raise the debt ceiling. They're going to allow for not only raising the debt ceiling, but also raising the budget allowances, the sort of budget sequester budget gaps for defense and domestic spending. They're going to delay, you won't have to vote on those again until March of 2017, not until the next president is elected. So it's going to give Ryan a year and a half lease on life where he's not going to have to deal with those same problems that John Boehner had to deal with.
We're talking to Harry Enten right now, senior political writer and analyst for 538. We're talking about the latest in national politics right now. So speaking of the budget, is this a win for everybody?
I mean, I think it is a win for everybody. I think most people are calling it a win-win. The budget, the government's going to keep functioning. That's a good thing, I think most people would say. Democrats are like that. Republicans who don't necessarily like the deal that was struck are going to be able to yell and say that we don't like the deal that was struck, and there won't be any consequences for yelling because the deal has already been struck. And Republicans who don't want to get blamed for any budget impasses will be able to point out and say, in fact, this Republican Congress did its job and the government's going to keep on functioning. So, yeah, I think it's a win for most people.
So staying with the Republican Party now, House Republicans also made news yesterday by moving to impeach the IRS chief. What's the story there? Where are we with that?
This is the type of thing that I think that is going to go absolutely nowhere. We hear a lot about impeaching people, and this has to go back, you know, with the IRS investigating Tea Party groups. But the IRS claims that they have fully cooperated, and polling indicates that most people see this as a partisan issue. And once things are divided between Democrats and Republicans fairly evenly, given that we have a divided government right now, and the Senate, even though it's in Republican control, is not a supermajority or even, you know, a closure-proof majority, 60 votes in the Senate for Republicans, it's just something that is just not going to go anywhere.
Well, let's look big picture now at the Republican Party. Nate Silver wrote a 538 piece wondering if the Republican Party is in disarray. This has been, it's been sort of a trope that's been running through political commentary for the past several years. But, you know, Nate's looking at the question, is it really? So what do you have to say about that? Where are we with that?
Well, you know, Nathaniel, who is my boss, and Nate and I get along great. We share smiles with each other in the hallway and online. But, you know, I think the question is whether or not the Republican Party, you know, coming back to the big question, why we're asking this question, will the Republican Party be able to nominate a candidate for president who appeals not only to the base of the Republican Party, but is someone who can win in the general election. And I think most people would agree that looking at the polling numbers and looking at the statements that the candidates have made, Donald Trump and Ben Carson are people who are just not going to be able to compete very competitively in a general election. Is the Republican Party going to be able to force the hand of the voters and be able to choose someone like a Marco Rubio or like a John Kasich or somebody who has elected office experience and can compel voters to vote for them, can speak to the center of the electorate in a general election? We just don't know the answer to that right now, because the number one thing that we look at is endorsements from elected officials. And on the Democratic side, we see Hillary Clinton getting well over 60% of them, while on the Republican side, Jeb Bush, who is leading the endorsement race, only has about 4% of the possible endorsements at this point. And that's leading. That is leading. So we're going to see if a candidate is able to get not only 4%, but 10, 20, 30, 40% as we go on in the primary season. So we don't know if the Republicans are in disarray or not. Right now, they are certainly not arrayed, but whether or not that continues is going to be the question that ultimately potentially determines whether or not Republicans can really compete in next year's general election.
Harry, thanks a lot for talking today.
Thanks so much.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time with the latest in national politics.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. There's been a lot of attention in cities around the country and here in Wisconsin on building a creative economy in an effort to attract and retain innovative businesses. But it's not just in big cities. There's been a growing effort to boost the arts in smaller cities, towns, and rural areas around the state.
Joining us now to discuss the rural arts boom in our state is Ann Katz, Executive Director of Arts Wisconsin. Ann, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
Well, I use the phrase arts boom there in rural Wisconsin. Is this happening? Are we really seeing a lot more creative endeavor in our smaller towns and communities?
Oh, absolutely. Although I will say that it's not necessarily that we're seeing more, although it does feel like that. It's that the importance of the arts sector and creative economy has never been more important. Wisconsin has always been a place where the arts are important to people at every level, big cities, small towns, rural areas, everywhere. It has to do with the Wisconsin idea and our progressive traditions. So we've always been a place where the arts really are important and spring from the grassroots. Now that we are in a new economy, not a recession anymore, a new economy, the whole issue of creativity, innovation, entrepreneurship, imagination, all of those attributes are important to the economy and civic life, and that's where the arts come in.
And let's talk about that. If we're in a rural county, say, or a small town or a smaller city around the state, what are the benefits? Why should I be interested in helping promote arts and creativity in my community?
Well, again, we're in a new economy, and people and communities that may have been known for one thing for a long time until the economy sort of started to change.
A factory,
you know, that we could name in a lot of communities in Wisconsin that depended on pretty much one industry for a long time. I heard an economist on public radio, of course, say that the U.S. economy seems to reinvent itself every 60 years or so. So end of the war to 2008, that's about 60 years. So now that we're in a new economy, and we know we're in a new economy, the whole idea of looking at the assets that a community has and making some money off them, branding your community, helping people, all people in that community have a good quality of life. That's really moving forward and moving to the forefront. So Wisconsin is full of creative people, beautiful landscapes, interesting history, lots of old buildings that can be repurposed. And in rural areas where they're looking to keep people in their communities and have people visit, all of those assets have become really important. And people are doing things with them. There's a huge amount of creativity and people moving forward to make sure that those assets are strong and keep going.
So I imagine if we're really lucky, these things will just fall into place magically in a community. But I'm guessing in most cases, it's something that somebody has to try to do to make happen.
Oh, magic. Yes. If only I had my magic wand. What we're seeing is that people are being purposeful and proactive. Somebody recently said this whole new economy thing is sort of like building a plane as you're flying it. And that's how we feel, because we know what the old economy was. We could touch it. We wish we could keep hold on to it. but we can't because the world is changing and the new economy is sort of right in front of us. We can see it, we're doing it, and we're figuring out how to do it as we go along. So the communities that are being successful, and by that I mean they keep moving forward, and there are many, are the ones that are looking at their assets, being strategic, being planful, as we say, and don't just sort of assume that things will happen because chipmunks will make them happen in the middle of the night.
Talking to Ann Katz from Arts Wisconsin about the role of the arts in rural communities and rural economies. Let's get into the kind of things that are happening. It seems like there's not a cookie cutter. There couldn't be. So talk about the range of ways that communities are embracing arts and creativity.
Well, for one thing, there are a lot of new and renovated art centers in Wisconsin. In the North Woods, there's a plethora of arts places and arts programs. Rhinelander, Minocqua, Three Lakes, Eagle River, they've all got new or restored art centers. So they're bringing touring musicians and touring performers in. They're definitely spotlighting local arts and branding those communities and establishing those communities as creative places. In Sauk County and southwestern Wisconsin, we could do a whole show just on that. The beautiful Driftless area, creative people living on the land, local food, local art, all of those kinds of attributes are going into the success and the ongoing work of places like American Players Theater, which had 114,000 people come to see shows this year and got 3 major reviews in the Wall Street Journal. In Sauk County, they just finished Fermentation Fest and the Farm Art Detour, run by the Worm Farm Institute, which is a wonderful organization that puts together art and agriculture. $2 million economic impact. 20,000 people came from mostly from outside of Sauk County to experience a public art driving tour and programs about fermentation, which could range from art to wine to vinegar to ideas to pickles. It's really up to every community to look at what they have there and to figure out how to do something with it. So it's very community-based, very locally focused. The money stays in the community. It helps attract people to visit and to decide to live in that kind of community. We've been really trying to help communities look at what their assets are and figure out how to keep moving forward with them.
Yeah, how does a community do that? Maybe some key stakeholders decide, okay, yeah, we want to expand our creative economy. How do they start? How do they figure out what they have to work with and how to promote that?
Well, I get a lot of calls from mayors and economic development people who say, well, how do we become a creative community? And first of all, your community is already creative because undoubtedly there are already artists and there are already creative people there who are making their living in that way. Eventually, along the way, when the right moment comes, a group of people usually get together and say, okay, we want to restore this building. We want to start this program. We want to help work on policy, and it can range from zoning policies to economic development kinds of things. And they start with small programs and small ideas and keep going along. And then another cool thing happens. And then the new mayor comes in and says, hey, how about if we have a public art program? Baraboo just started a public art program that is being led by the city with a group of private citizens helping to actually make it happen and private investment. And so there isn't one, again, there's not one strategy. And I will say it's not a short-term thing. All of us would like instant jobs, instant businesses, instant vitality in our community. And that happens over time, but this kind of economy is very based on small business, on entrepreneurship, on community. And so there has to be buy-in from the community. The best kind of project, program, or initiative happens when as much as possible, everyone's voice is heard. And so that's, personalities and politics absolutely play a role in it. I've learned a huge amount about human nature in this job. And it's really encouraging and inspiring to me to see how people keep moving these things forward, even though sometimes you think, oh, well, this isn't working, let's just give up. But then they keep doing it again, and eventually it works.
Sounds like a key is to start small. I can imagine somebody might think, oh, art, so what? We have to build, you know, a museum or some major public investment of some sort. You can ease into this a little
bit. Oh, yes. I once dealt with a wonderful, inspiring guy who wanted to put like a $27 million art center in a very small town in northwestern Wisconsin. This wasn't the right fit, but it was his vision. Starting small is not necessarily the issue. It's starting realistically and reasonably, just pushing the envelope, continuing to say, you know, we've got this wonderful program. We've got this wonderful group. Let's see what we can make of it. We've got this building to restore. Let's restore it and see what happens. Over time, and, you know, with a lot of hard work, effort, investment, that effort keeps building. You know, a place, I mean, Door, for example, Door County, to use a rural example, has been known as an arts destination for a long time, but it didn't start that way. It built over time, a long time, but it built over time. In southwestern Wisconsin, places like Mineral Point had a sort of resurgence and renaissance in the 70s when artists moved in and started buying up those old, beautiful old miners' buildings and cottages and restoring them. And then over time, Mineral Point has definitely been known as an arts destination. The Al Ringling Theater in Baraboo has been there for a long time, and it's just being restored and will open in February. That process to get it restored has gone on for quite a long time in terms of raising money and figuring out the historical aspects, but now they've finally reached that moment. So perseverance, patience, and a lot of chutzpah.
We're talking right now with Ann Katz, Executive Director of Arts Wisconsin, looking at the increasing role that the arts play in revitalizing rural communities.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Maybe you're an artist who's working and living in a rural community or smaller town in Wisconsin. We'd love to know if this sounds like what your community is going through, or maybe you're noticing the change in your small town. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Ann Katz, Executive Director of Arts Wisconsin, about the increasing role that the arts play in revitalizing Wisconsin's rural communities.
And we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is your community seeing an arts boom? Do you think that your small town or county could do more to attract the arts, or this maybe not be a priority to you? We'd love to hear your opinion. Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to our callers. We've got Jim on the line in Harvard, Illinois. Jim, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
All right, it's fantastic. Fine arts need a punch in the arm, and there are a lot of viewers out there that are need that social aspect, especially in rural areas. There's a lot of people that live within cities, and now they want the rural area. Here in Harvard, Illinois, we have the Starline Art Gallery. And what we do here is we have a juried art show, and we see 500, no kidding, 500 to 700 people for a one-night juried art show. It's phenomenal. It's called the Starline Art Gallery on Front Street here in Harvard. And that just pushes off other people from Wisconsin to invite. And we get a two-hour radius of people that jury in for the show. It's pretty phenomenal.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. And just a one event like that, he's saying, bringing in people from a pretty wide radius. Do we see that in towns around Wisconsin?
Oh, absolutely. We have a plethora of studio and gallery tours around the state that people come from in the state and outside of the state to go to a beautiful place and see art, purchase art, and enjoy the beautiful countryside. But Jim brought up a really good point that, you know, there are so many layers of wonderfulness when there's a creative economy, as the creative economy is developing in rural areas and in big cities, of course, which is that it's not only jobs and business, which is an important aspect. It's also tourism. People come to visit. And most importantly, in terms of sort of the community, it's quality of life for the people in the community. So people want to live in a community at any level. People want to live in a community where there are good schools, good parks, libraries, good arts programs for their kids. And that is a major reason why this kind of, I guess, economy or this kind of infrastructure has been in Wisconsin and is developing in Wisconsin, because people want good places to live and they want to visit fun places too.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Jackie in Sun Prairie. Jackie, hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I am very aware of a lot of initiation in regard to the arts across the state, but I think one of the oldest ones is something by John Stewart Curry, who set up the Wisconsin Regional Art Program before, a number of years ago, it was Rural Arts Program, and it has attracted a lot of amateur artists and a lot of people into making their art. Now, that said, I happened to take a motorcycle trip up the Great River Road in early September and went through many, many small towns in the Driftless area. And one particular town was not exactly pretty, but it had a big old store that had been redone into a maker's studio. And in this maker's studio, people were doing crafts. They were taking old things and making them into new things. And then there was quite a lot of art in the place, too.
Great.
This town, you know, was extraordinary, out in the middle of nowhere doing this kind of stuff.
Jackie, thank you so much for sharing that. A lot there to talk about. And let's start with that makerspace idea. It doesn't just have to be, you know, paintings up on a wall. There's a lot of different ways to attack this creative economy.
Oh,
idea.
Well, absolutely. Let's not get into a discussion of what is art and who's an artist, because the beautiful thing is that there are people who make their living as artists, and there's a lot of ways to define that. It's sort of a personal thing is how you figure that out for yourself. And even more that, you know, everyone has some kind of creative angle in their lives and creative spark. And so most people don't call themselves artists, but they make art in some ways, either whether it's crafts or whether it's food or whether it's woodworking. But there has been an explosion sort of in makerspaces in small towns and big cities, and which give people the opportunity to do that work. I should also talk about John Stewart Curry one moment. Then I can talk about the Great River Road. John Stewart Curry was the first artist in residence in the country at a major land-grant institution in the mid-30s, and so that's one way Wisconsin has led. The great thing about that is that he was based in the ag school, not the art school, and I've always loved that. That just shows how forward-thinking those leaders were at that time, to put him in the ag school to help people who would not necessarily think of themselves as artists or creative people to be involved in the arts. So he started that tradition. Aaron Bowrod was another well-known artist in residence at the university. And now the university, not just in Madison, but around the state, the university system has a lot of arts opportunities and artists in residence kinds of programs and community programs. So, you know, again, the Wisconsin idea, bringing the resources of the university system to the people of the state, that has always really focused on the arts. And just to really say something about the Great River
Sure,
Road,
yeah.
That's another part of rural Wisconsin that is hopping. Stockholm, Alma, Pepin, Maiden Rock, that third, I think they call it the West Coast of Wisconsin, but beautiful small towns, really creative people making their living there. They just did the Flyway Film Festival in those Pepin, Alma, Stockholm towns. There's the Wide Spot Performing Arts Center in Stockholm. It's a town of 66 people, and they can get, you know, 100-150 people coming to a performance. So, you know, that's another area where there are a huge number of creative people doing wonderful things. Again, there's creative people everywhere in the state.
Thanks for that call, Jackie. We're talking to Ann Katz from Arts Wisconsin about arts and revitalizing Wisconsin's rural communities. Back to our callers now. Steve is on the line in Shell Lake. Steve, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm representing the Shell Lake Art Center, which has been in existence for 48 years, is an arts and music and art education center, and it runs nine weeks of summer camps in the summer. It's served 30,000 people over the course of the past 48 years and runs about approximately 600 students a summer coming for music and art education. My question to your guest is, we are in the middle of a capital campaign because our dormitory system is rapidly failing. It's 50 years old and needs to be rebuilt. And I'm wondering, what can Arts Wisconsin do to help us in this capital campaign to rebuild this center and ensure another 50 years of excellent arts education.
And I'm sure you can't commit to a specific thing, but what sorts of things are out there to help a situation
well,
like
let
that?
Me just say that the first time I ever went to the Shell Lake Arts Center, when it was called the Indian Head Arts and Education Center, there was a sign that said, bringing the Wisconsin idea to life above the door. So I knew I would love that place right away. Arts Wisconsin does, we do advocacy service and development. We're the voice for the arts in the state. We're a community cultural development organization. So no, I can't do the work for the people. I can't raise the money for you. But we have a lot of resources and information and technical assistance to help organizations, communities, and people do their work. So, Steve, get in touch with me. But we do a lot of technical assistance. We help do planning kinds of things. We have a huge amount of information on things like fundraising and you know, how to do your work. So we're a service organization. I do have to say one more thing. One of the other things we do is, you know, we do everything from helping artists write business plans to lobbying the legislature. And we have a bill now starting to go in front of the legislature called the Creative Economy Development Initiative, which is all about investing in Wisconsin's creative economy. So if you go to artswisconsin.org, that's our website, there's information about that. But we've really started to get a lot of good feedback from legislators that this is the kind of tool and resource that they are looking for to help revitalize economies in small towns and big cities.
And we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Ann Katz, Executive Director of Arts Wisconsin. She's also, by the way, a member of the Wisconsin Public Radio Association Board. By the way, we'd love to hear from you. If you've got something going on in your community, rural or urban or in between, with creativity, with the arts, and you want to tell us about it, tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us a message. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Maybe even send a picture along with it. Because we know you've been hoping and praying for just this very thing, we're happy to bring you the big musical news. Phil Collins is back.
That's right. The longtime member of Genesis has announced that retirement is over for him. He's got a new album, and he's open to a Genesis reunion. Lots of possibilities there. So a lot of exciting stuff for Phil Collins fans to get psyched about.
And big questions about rumors of Genesis reunions. Would Peter Gabriel be involved? Probably not, is the word, if that were to happen. Well, to celebrate or to bring you into the loop, if you have no idea who we're talking about, say you're under 30, our amazing engineer Joe Hartke put together this brief appreciation of the work of Phil Collins and Genesis. Collins there. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.